Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It's the Disruption Zone. I'm Leland Conway. So here's an interesting topic. I don't know how I feel about it. So multiple times there's this law that's come up called Marcy's Law. And now it's going to be on the ballot in Kentucky for constitutional decision. So in other words, an amendment. And you're going to get to vote on this. Now, here's why I don't know how I feel about this. Because people I respect stand on both sides of this law. And people I respect have explained good points for and against it. Marcy's Law is intended, at least according to those promoting it, to be a victim's rights law, something that provides more rights to victims of crimes, especially violent crimes. But on the other side of this, there are people saying that it does kind of the opposite, at least it has in other states, and that it's too vaguely written for us to really know what it is we're actually talking about or discussing, and for Kentuckians to know what it is they're actually voting on. So I want to bring on one of the sponsors of that law and see if he can convince me that it's the right thing to do. The ACLU of Kentucky, including Republican senators and former law enforcement officers of some and some really great legal minds, have spoken out against this law. Then again, on the other side, there's people I really respect who support it. And it's hard to be against something that claims to be for victims' rights. So let's dive into the conversation and see where this takes us. State Senator Whitney Westerfield. On the Disruption Zone. Senator Westerfield, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Leland. Good to talk with you.
Did you see where California's banned Thanksgiving?
I saw some headlines about that. I'm not sure that they ever celebrated it in the first place.
That's a good point. I think America ought to really think twice before we hand the country over to these left-wing nut jobs. I mean, it's like, here's the thing. Are you guys in the legislature going to let Governor McGrabby Hands Beshear do something like that? Because that's who he doesn't look to his constituents. He looks to those guys. Like, I think it was Michigan's governor who's forcing bars and restaurants to take people's phone numbers and names. New York's Governor Cuomo says he discourages family gatherings at Thanksgiving and Christmas. And Gavin Newsom has basically banned Thanksgiving by saying that you can't have non-sanctioned. The government has to sanction your family gatherings in your home. It's really crazy. And that's who Beshear looks to. Are you guys going to stop him from doing something stupid like that?
That sure is our plan. I mean, there are a number of bills already floating around that would limit his use of executive power during states of emergency, that would limit states of emergency being declared or how long they could last without some sort of oversight by the legislative branch. I tell you, what I'm really kicking myself for, and it's not my fault, it never even got out of the House this year, but it was a constitutional amendment that would have allowed the legislature to reserve days during its regular session and call itself into an extraordinary session instead of having to rely on the governor to do it for a limited amount of time and for reasons that it deemed appropriate, not having to rely on the governor to issue a call that's limited in scope.
Right.
Now, if we had gotten that out of the legislature this year, it would have been on the ballot this coming Tuesday,
right,
and it wouldn't have taken effect until the vote was certified by the Board of Elections. But at least in the future, when the next one of these comes up, whenever that is, heaven forbid, we're not hogtied to a chief executive. And listen, man, we didn't always agree with the last chief executive of the Commonwealth,
right,
in the Republican caucuses in the legislature. I think the legislature ought to have the power to do that and call itself into session when it thinks it needs to. And right now, there's no question that there needs to be some reining in on the use of executive power.
Yeah, I agree. We'll see what happens, but he certainly isn't listening to his constituents. The fact that he didn't talk to you guys in the legislature, who most closely represent his constituents, is just, you know, stunning to me, the way that he's governed through all of this. But
I've had the best relationships I've got with the executive branch right now are with the Justice Cabinet, related to criminal justice issues and policies. And I appreciate that as judiciary chair. And that's helpful. And I have enjoyed that sort of relationship. And he's got, you know, former Deputy Chief Justice Mary Noble as the Justice Cabinet Secretary. And Secretary Noble and I get along really well and have trust there, and that's good. I don't get that sort of feedback from just about any other branch of the executive branch of government. And that's frustrating, particularly when we're the ones, as you just said, are seeing our constituents every day, hearing from them every single day, fielding the phone calls and the emails and the text messages and the Facebook messages from all those people directly who are still struck to this day. I mean, I've answered several today that are waiting on unemployment income.
Right. Wow. Insurance. It's unbelievable. Today. 8-9 months every afterwards.
Day. Every day.
Wow. That's just unacceptable.
Dealt with one last week that was an April filer. I mean, April? What in the world is the problem?
Wow. Wow.
Halloween's tomorrow.
And how is it that we're a month from
Thanksgiving and we're still this poor person from April and how, doesn't have their UI?
How in the world is it that this governor skates on this with the media? Can you imagine what a Republican administration would be facing under this situation right now? I mean, it would be every single day, full page spreads, pictures of the people who can't get their unemployment, detailed stories about their life and struggle against their horrible Republican governor. This media in this state, crickets when it's a Democrat in office.
It's very frustrating to see the bias come out in that way, and it's predictable and reliable. The bias is that because you're absolutely right. The kind of expose. In fact, the New York Times just did one and actually highlighted. They used the Owensboro Messenger Inquirer and highlighted a young woman from Owensboro. I assume Davis County somewhere. It may not have been Owensboro in Davis County, but it was in that area. And she was a waiter or a waitress and lost her job, has been struggling to find work. And they did several just human interest stories and telling the stories of these people that have struggled. I don't remember seeing any criticism of the complete failure to get tens of thousands of UI claims sorted out over 9 months.
If it's the New York Times, I'm sure they found a way to blame Trump. So for that instead of Governor Beshear. So let's dive into Marcy's Law. I am genuinely unconvinced on this. There's people that I respect deeply on both sides. Obviously, I have a lot of respect and friendship for you. You support it. I also have been a longtime supporter of the Tea Party, and there are members of leadership of the Tea Party in Kentucky who are dead set against this law. There's a lot of confusion swirling around it. The ACLU has a piece about it that was actually written by some conservatives in saying that they were shocked that they agreed with them, saying that the language was inconsistent and confusing. Saying that it doesn't do what it is purported to do, that is granting victims rights. And let me finish laying it out, and then I want you to, because I'm genuinely unconvinced. I want to give you an opportunity to explain, you know, what I'm hearing and where what I'm hearing is wrong. I actually had somebody tell me that this law actually, if you had somebody carjack you in a car and you defended yourself, that it could potentially turn the person who attacked you into
the baloney.
Okay, well, that's fine. I'm going to give you a chance to do that, but help me deconstruct this and tell me why all of that is wrong and why people that I respect on the other side are saying these things. So what is it? What's wrong about the things that are out there?
Every one of the arguments that you just floated right now are complete baloney. None of them are based in fact or in the law. None of them, and some of them, frankly, are based on people's arguments who clearly haven't taken the time to read the amendment.
Okay.
So let's go through a couple of these things, and let's start with that very first one. You mentioned a carjacking. The same fact pattern, except with a different crime, has been circulated. It went around 2 years ago in 2018 when this was on the ballot before the Supreme Court did its thing and overruled the will of the voters. And we can get into that more in a bit. It circulated 2 years ago. It's back around now. And the scenario that I was familiar with, that's the first time I've heard carjacking, but it's burglar. So let's say Joe Burglar breaks into Leland's house and Leland shoots him to defend his home, defend his family. And so now that guy's the victim and can use these rights against. That's baloney. It's absolute garbage. What's the first thing the burglar or the carjacker is going to have to do to claim they're the victim? They're going to have to admit that they were burglarizing your house or carjacking your car.
Right.
They're going to have to admit they were doing something that's absolutely felonious. They're not the victim. They're the defendant, and their case should go to trial. The irony, the cruel irony, is that if that case went to trial today, the victim has no rights, and the accused has constitutional rights. The carjacker or the burglar, whatever assailant in your fact pattern you want to use, today has constitutional protections that the victim does not have in Kentucky.
And I think that's not right.
The argument there is preposterous.
Right. What constitutional protections does the criminal have that the victim doesn't have today?
Well, the victims in Kentucky have no constitutional rights, full stop. No victim in Kentucky has any constitutional rights.
According to the ACLU, the victims do have rights. Here's the thing,
and I know this is going to blow your mind and the mind of your listeners, but the ACLU is being disingenuous.
I'm not surprised by that. I'm simply
Senator Westerfield, just understand,
I'm not coming at this from an antagonistic point of view. I'm coming at this from the point of view of someone who's genuinely unconvinced, who has heard things on both sides from people I respect on both sides. I'm trying to deconstruct it so that I understand it. Now, I'm using the ACLU as a source, but there's an article that they wrote in which they said that they already have victims.
Let me finish
because the reason we have.
But you, repetition matters, man. You keep saying it over and over again.
No. You haven't let me get to the actual point that I'm making, because this is important, because there's people out there who may think wrongly so what I'm about to say is true. And that's why I want to give you a chance to hear it out and then explain why it's wrong. What the ACLU said is that victims already have constitutional rights to a speedy notification of someone being released from jail. Again, refute it, please. But just understand, if that's what's being said wrongly out there, we have to get it out, and then you have to explain why that's not true.
Well, it is absolutely, patently, 100% completely untrue. There are zero constitutional protections for crime victims in Kentucky today. None. There are statutory protections, two, maybe three, depending on how you interpret the statute, for crime victims. And one of those is notice of hearings that are going on. That's the first right in Marcy's Law. But those two or three statutory rights only apply to victims of 21 crimes that are specified in the statute. So we've got over 400 crimes on the books in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Only 21 crimes have their victims set apart as having some mediocre milquetoast rights in the statute right now. Every other victim in Kentucky has zero rights, period. Mm-hmm. So when the ACLU says that this is doing something we don't need because victims already have rights, that's horse crap, unless you're one of the quote-unquote lucky victims of these 21 crimes in the statute. And even then, the argument turns to, well, but why don't we just put, if we need these 12 rights, Whitney, why don't we just put them all in the statute? Because statutory rights are subordinate to constitutional rights. And as long as the victim is treated as subordinate to the accused, they can be ignored, just as they are today. Even with the puny statutory right to notice that the victims of those 21 crimes have today, can be easily ignored and overlooked. And even if it is, the victims today don't have the legal standing to argue or assert their rights. Marcy's Law changes that too. We don't create party status for the victim. They shouldn't be a party. It's the Commonwealth or the government versus John Smith for the alleged crimes. Those are the parties. So we can't grant the victim party status, but we can give them the very limited authority to assert just the rights we give them. And Marcy's Law, unlike other states, which really pushes and goes for 17 or 20 different rights for victims, we've given them 12. 11 substantive rights, and then the 12th is the standing to enforce and assert the first 11 rights.
Okay, real quick, can you give me maybe just a broad example of some of the types of crimes that are not included in the 21 that are statutorily protected?
Sure. Well, the 21 include your most serious crimes. There are a couple of the most serious misdemeanors that are in that group. I think some sex offenses that are in that group of misdemeanors. But most of them are your murder, rape, burglary, first-degree burglary, or arson, I think, may be in that group. And I forget what the other ones are of the 21. But it's every other crime. And because they're the most serious, they're also the least frequently offended or committed acts. So again, we have tens of thousands of victims in Kentucky, mm-hmm. and a scarce few of them, thankfully, ever fall into the group of these 21. Right. So most victims in Kentucky have no rights at all. And that's a problem that Marcy's Law solves. Putting them in the Constitution solves the problem that putting them in statute would create, because they'd still be second-class citizens and subordinate. Their rights would be subordinate and second-class to the rights of the accused. And here's the thing. No one, not me, not anybody else, not the 100-plus legislators who voted for it in both parties, not the overwhelming number of Kentuckians who voted for it 2 years ago before the Supreme Court became almighty and ignored their vote and tossed it out. So we've got these 12 limited rights. These rights exist in a situation. They're all what I call procedural rights. These rights are aimed at giving the victim a meaningful voice in the process. They don't get to have control over it. Victim can't force an outcome, can't guarantee or demand and compel the judge to do a darn thing. Can't compel the prosecutor to do a darn thing. They're not built that way. And if they did, if they were, it would achieve what some have argued this does, but it doesn't do. And that is give the victim the upper hand. And that's we're not trying to, and all these, all the folks that support this, if this gave the victim more rights than the accused, that would be a perverse outcome and wrong. It shouldn't be that way. But right now there's an imbalance in the other direction. Right. The accused have the rights, and the victims have none in the Constitution.
Okay, but this is
and we should. But let me finish.
Yeah,
we should be able to give victims those constitutional protections in a way that doesn't interfere in the slightest with the rights of the accused. And remember, 35 other states have done this. Some of those states have had these rights on their books for 30 years. You know, in Kentucky right now, that no victim, not even the 21 crimed victims, no victim in Kentucky has the right to be present at their own trial, and that you have prosecutors in the state today who will strategically subpoena their victim to make sure that they get caught by what the lawyers in Kentucky know is the rule of separation. So if you've got a trial and you've got all your witnesses subpoenaed, none of the witnesses who are subpoenaed can be in the room and hear the other witnesses testify. And so they'll subpoena their victim, whether they need them to testify or not, just to make sure they can't be in the room.
Right.
Because it's strategically viable or whatever. I think that's bogus. And I think a victim ought to be present in the room and have a right to be present. When I tell constituents that you don't have a right to be in the trial for your own case,
right,
they're appalled by that. If you're able to be in there today, it's because the court didn't throw you out and the lawyers for the two sides didn't ask for you to be thrown out. It's not because you've got a right to be there. And Marcy's Law fixes that. Arizona's had the right to be present for 30 years. It's never once, not one time, ever been challenged successfully as hurting the right of the accused.
No, it makes sense. In a way, the way our justice system is supposed to work is you have a right to face your accuser. And what you're saying.
And they have a right to face. That's
right.
Absolutely. And the accuser ought to have a right to be in the room for that process.
But one argument that maybe is the one that resonates the most with me, and explain if this is right or wrong, but it's just, I, you know, read pieces on this.
Yeah.
And that is that it essentially makes, it weakens your rights as an accused. Because one thing we have to remember about our justice system is that the accused is always innocent until proven guilty.
That's right.
Now, I do support the idea that once somebody is convicted, that people who were their victims should absolutely be notified.
And a couple of these rights only apply after conviction.
So is that a true argument that Marcy's Law weakens the rights of those who are accused of a crime?
It is absolutely not true. First of all, the argument that this diminishes the presumption of innocence is baloney here in Kentucky. It's bogus. Not in the other 35 states anywhere is that argument been successful or upheld by any court. It doesn't challenge the presumption of innocence. And just out of an abundance of caution, we went one step further in Kentucky. We restate the presumption of innocence in the amendment. Mm. This goes back to my point earlier. People clearly aren't reading the thing.
Right.
We say it's on page two, line 10 and 11 of the bill that we passed, Senate Bill 15, which is the amendment. The numbers won't be lined on your ballots, but you can see the language there about two-thirds of the way in. We restate and reaffirm that the presumption of innocence shall not be hurt by these rights. And I challenge people to think even further about what the rights are. And there are just 12 of them, like I said. none of them give any sort of leg to the victim to do something to the presumption of innocence. How does the right to be notified of a hearing affect the presumption of innocence?
Right.
How does the right to be present affect the presumption of innocence? How does the right to restitution, which is only upon conviction,
right,
affect the presumption of innocence?
So those are three that you just mentioned. What are the other nine rights that this gives to victims?
I'm going to pull them up here so that
no worries.
I'm going to read through all 12. Here they are. The reasonable right upon request to timely notice of all proceedings. That's number one. So you actually have to request that right before it kicks in.
Okay.
And let me preface this. I'm going to read these two. Let me preface it by saying, and here's another myth that's out there. I had a good friend of mine, a good conservative guy, Christian guy, who claims that this would allow, he sent out a big mail piece to however many people he sent the newsletter to and put it on a YouTube video and on his Facebook page, claiming that this would allow someone to go to the judge and demand and force the judge to take your guns away. First of all, this doesn't do a darn thing about your Second Amendment rights. It doesn't touch them, affect them at all. It's got nothing to do with that. He's thinking about red flag laws.
Right.
And that's a serious issue that does have due process concerns. This isn't that. And secondly, and my point, is that all of these rights only kick in once there's an actual case in front of a judge. So you can't skip the process. There's got to be a criminal case. Someone actually has to be charged and in front of the court before any of these rights apply. Mm-hmm. So the first one is the right to notice of proceedings, and you have to request it before it kicks in. Number two, the right to be heard in any proceeding involving release, plea, sentencing, or in the consideration, and this is the one line that's different from 2018, the consideration of any pardon, commutation, or reprieve, or other matter involving the right of a victim other than grand jury proceedings. So grand jury proceedings are a special thing, and those have to be secret, and the victim can't be in there. But if it's a hearing involving the release, the plea, or sentencing of the defendant, then the victim ought to have a right to be heard in those proceedings. And
does
if
it,
the
does
governor's
it take
gonna
the, does it take? Oh, you were about to say that. Never mind. I interrupted you. Go ahead. I was going to say about pardon.
No, and in the consideration of a pardon, commutation, or a granting of a reprieve, nothing short of a constitutional amendment repealing that power of the governor or limiting that power can the governor's power be cut off. We're not stopping the governor. The governor can hear the victim and still, and victim can be adamantly opposed to a pardon or a commutation.
Right.
But the governor can still grant it if the governor wishes. We're just saying the victim's input ought to be gathered here before, or an attempt should be made at least. Maybe the victim's MIA,
right,
or just refuses to talk, but at least make an effort. And the whole reason that one line was added from 2 years ago, someone said to me last winter after the Bevin administration pardons and commutations that made the news everywhere happened, someone said, Whitney, if the Supreme Court hadn't tossed it out, would the victims have been protected in that process? And I said, I think arguably yes, but not absolutely certain. So let's just make it explicit.
Right.
Supreme Court's forced us to go back. Let's add one line that says so. So that's what we did.
Right.
Number three. The right to be present at trial on all other proceedings other than grand jury proceedings on the same basis as the accused. So other than grand jury, everywhere the accused can be there, you can be there.
Okay.
Four, the right to proceedings free from unreasonable delay. That's consistent with the right to a speedy trial that the accused has. So those are complementary. Five, the right to consult with the attorney for the Commonwealth or the Commonwealth's designee. The right to talk to the prosecutor. I mean, how in the world does that interrupt any of the rights of the accused? Number six, the right to reasonable protection from the accused and those acting on behalf of the accused throughout the criminal and juvenile justice process. I can't tell you the number of times either the defendant or the family members of the defendant made threats to victims, mm-hmm. made threats to the prosecutor, made threat to the investigating law enforcement official, or made threats to the court or the attorneys. We're just saying the victim ought to have a right to reasonable protection from the accused. And that could be something as simple as a restriction on their release conditions. Mm-hmm. You know, don't go within a mile of so-and-so's house, what have you. Number seven, the right to timely notice upon request. So another one the victim actually has to ask for to trigger. And by the way, that upon request in this right and in the very first one about notice of all proceedings, those were requests by the prosecutors. I don't agree with either one of them. I don't like either one of those concessions, but it was a compromise. They wanted to put upon request in there so that they weren't overburdened with a whole bunch of notices for victims that didn't care about cases and didn't have any interest in being involved in the proceedings. And so we agreed with that reluctantly. So the argument that this is going to weigh down prosecutors because of all the notices they've got to send is also not legitimate. They asked for this to relieve them of that burden. And the rest of the cases, they're already sending notices on. Most of these rights codify what most prosecutors' offices are already doing. I suspect that the ones that are complaining the loudest are the ones that aren't doing this well enough, and they know that they're about to be called on it. So number seven, the right to timely notice upon request of release or escape of the accused. Who could argue with that?
Right.
Number eight, the right to have the safety of the victim and the victim's family considered in setting bail, determining whether to release the defendant, and setting conditions of release after arrest and conviction. So, again, this codifies what judges do without telling anybody. Judges today consider the safety not just of the general public, but of the victim or the family. Is this defendant who's presumed innocent, but is there a risk because of the facts of the case? Is there some indication or threats that have been made? Is there some indication there are dangers to the victim or the family of the victim? Let's put restrictions on bail and so forth. Again, just have the safety considered in setting bail. The right. judge could still say, I don't think there is a safety risk. I'm going to let the guy out without any restrictions. Doesn't tie the judge's hands. It just says consider. Number nine, the right to full restitution to be paid by the convicted or adjudicated party. That doesn't exist for crime victims today of any kind. Number 10, the right to fairness and due consideration of the crime victim's safety, dignity, and privacy. Now, this is a big one the ACLU also likes to make a stink about. They argue, they keep talking about Florida. Florida has a different provision that's very different from what we have in Kentucky. Right. They actually create an affirmative right to privacy that victims are able to hide behind and actually preclude or prohibit or stop the disclosure of certain evidence. That is a humongous constitutional problem in Florida. We don't have that language in ours and never have had it because we saw that issue. We just have the right to have your safety and dignity and privacy considered by the court. Number 11, the right to be informed of these enumerated rights. So everybody's familiar with the Miranda warning that, mm-hmm. that the accused get because of a Supreme Court case out of Arizona. From decades ago, you have the right to remain silent, blah, 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 blah. Everything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have a right to an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, want to be a foreign appointed for you, blah, blah, blah. This is that right, but for victims. We're saying you should not just have these rights. You have a right to be told these rights. And then the last one is, as I mentioned, standing to assert just these rights. So we're not giving them the standing to make any other arguments. You can't go in there and ask for something else or demand some other outcome. You only have the power to argue for these first 11 things in front of that one, and that's it.
So what do you think is the reason behind the pushback and the controversy? And why are you getting so much friendly fire?
I honestly think it's because people who either haven't read it or they've read something that they believe from someone else who didn't read it and didn't do their homework.
Right.
The thing about the Joe burglar, I mean, that one really stupefies me, and I can't explain that. People are worried that this affects your self-defense rights and your stand-your-ground law here in Kentucky, the Castle Doctrine. It doesn't touch that at all. But I think people latch on to things that have some sense of plausibility and they're afraid of it.
Yeah.
And so they put up the defense and they refuse to consider the reality that the argument is preposterous.
Right.
And of course, a clear reading of the amendment, there are no changes at all. None whatsoever to your self-defense rights, to your Second Amendment rights, to the presumption of innocence, to the due process protections for the accused. And even if Marcy's Law is passed next week, the accused still has U.S. constitutional rights that the victims do not have.
Right.
So even if you were convinced that the 12 rights I've just read through were just horrific, The accused still has a backstop for the U.S. Constitution that victims don't have. They still win. And I think that will be borne out. You know, the frustrating thing.
Well, there is a reason traditionally why there is a slight advantage to the accused, and that again,
well, their liberty is at stake, right?
Right, exactly. And so you want to make sure that balance remains. I know it sounds terrible to say that, because it's very difficult to be against victims' rights, but at the same time, you know,
but that's just it. You don't have to be against victims.
Right.
This is the frustrating narrative that people seem to latch on to. We're not trying to give them an equal
standing
set of rights.
Right.
Because what you just said is absolutely true. We're talking about someone's liberty, and in some cases, someone's life.
Right.
And they stand accused of a crime that the Commonwealth has its highest burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. To meet its burden of proof before they can convict someone, those rights are bedrock principles of our Constitution. And I've gone through every one of these counter arguments with the Tea Party of Kentucky folks, with the ACLU, with the Criminal Defense Bar. Some of them are just still adhering to demonstrably false claims, because that's just the pony they're riding. And I can't explain that. I've talked to the person that I mentioned put out that mail piece, our little flyer to their friends and followers about this, the gun rights thing. I said, show me where in this amendment it does any of that.
Right.
None of these rights give the victim power to force anything.
Right.
And they certainly can't go to a judge before there's a case that exists. I mean, the rights are what they are. They all relate to a case.
Right. Right.
So they stick to that, but here's where I was going.
Yeah.
The objective is not to create an equal set of rights between victims and the accused, because their positions are different, as we've just said. Mm-hmm. The objective is to give the rights that they have or should have equal legal significance or weight.
Okay.
And right now, victims don't have any constitutional protections, and they should.
Right.
They shouldn't be able to control the case. They shouldn't be able to demand and force a certain outcome, or force a sentence, or force someone to be held in custody, or force their release. They shouldn't be able to force X, Y, and Z. They should just be heard. They should be informed. And what I've learned over the last 5 years working on this, that's another issue, by the way, as a brief aside, one of the frustrating things, and people argue about why we should be really reluctant to amend the Constitution, I wholeheartedly agree. This is the fifth year we've kicked this amendment around and debated it in podcasts like this, media interviews, Kiwanis and Rotary meetings around the state. It's been debated at length. Amendment number 2 on the ballot came out of nowhere. For the first time, this session passed and is now on the ballot for voters to consider. It's never been debated before and discussed before this year, and hasn't gotten nearly the ink. And we're talking about doubling judges' terms of office.
Right.
I think that's crazy.
But
as I say all that to say this, the victims ought to have these constitutional protections that are limited to the procedure of a court case.
Right.
And be given that constitutional weight so that they're not ignored. And one thing I've learned is that so many victims are ignored because they don't have rights today in the Constitution.
Right. Well, I'll say this. I got to wrap it up, but I'll say this. As you know, I live in Colorado now, and Colorado has had, excuse me, a victims' rights constitutional amendment since 1992. And I'm not aware of any issues that have arisen out of that for, you know, victims or the accused. And what I'll say to people is this: before you make a decision on voting for it, make sure you've actually read.
Oh, for goodness sake, please read it
first, right? I mean,
please.
Because I appreciate you taking the time to sort of lay all of this out. And I want people to actually read something. Don't just take you read an article on the Courier Journal or the Herald Leader or whatever. Don't take that and say, oh, well, I'm for it or
100%.
I'm against it.
I 100% agree with you, and yeah. I've been sharing links to the full text of it. It's been online for
will you send that to me so I can put it in the post that I put up on the podcast website so people can actually go read it for themselves. We make sure that's in there.
Absolutely. And, awesome. And I tell you what, the best resource, you can find the ballot language. You can find a ton of resources at the website, and I'll send this to you, but it's victimsrightsky.com. Victimsrightsky.com, all one word. And you can find a big button up at the top of the page, read ballot language.
Awesome.
You can find the groups that support it. And there are dozens of Kentucky organizations that have made and looked at Kentucky's own amendment, which is not identical to every other state that has it.
Right.
And they see the value in making that part of our Constitution. And we're talking about groups on the left, groups on the right, groups in the middle. Every law enforcement group in the state, every statewide association supports it, from the sheriffs to the chiefs of police to the FOP and State Police Professional Association. It's a good, diverse group of Kentuckians that are devoted to taking care of us around the state. And to have their support means a ton.
Well, listen, Whitney, it's always good to talk to you. We appreciate it. I appreciate you trying to run check and balances on the governor. And all of that. And like I said, I want people to read this before they make a decision. So we're going to put it on the website. And I want them to listen to what you said. I want them to listen to the explanations, because as far as I know, I think we went point by point through all of the major arguments against it. And I think that will be very helpful to people who are trying to make up their mind. So I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much. And we look forward to chatting again soon.
Thanks, Leland.
All right. Take it easy. Have a good one. Yeah. So that's Senator Whitney Westerfield. There you go. I just look, I don't know why it's controversial, but it is. So I just want you to actually read the bill and, you know, make it happen. So figure out what you decide, you know, decide which way you want it to go. Just decide which way you want to vote. So there you go. As I said, I live in Colorado now, so I can't vote. But we do have a Marcy's Law in Colorado. I don't know what the structural differences of the two bills are, but we'll figure it out. But take a look at it. And there you go. So, hey, thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills. Thanks to Louisville Cabinets and Countertops for their sponsorship of this program. Go to LouisvilleCabinetsandCountertops.com. And thanks to JP Web Design and also Dynamics Audio Productions in Lexington, Kentucky for their help with this program. You can download us for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and iHeartRadio app. You can also find us on Twitter. It's at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption and at Greatly Londo on Instagram and at The Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening to The Disruption Zone.